Between 1947 and 1953, Yugoslavia poured some $53 million, a staggering sum, into the pursuit of an atomic bomb. Edvard Kardel, one of Marshal Josip Tito's closest associates, said in 1950, "We must have the bomb. We must build it even if it costs us one half of our income for years." Yugoslavia was uniquely positioned to achieve the bomb, but in the end they didn't. The bomb project, in all practicality, ended in 1970. In this video, we look at Tito's drive for the atomic bomb and why it failed. Before we begin, I want to call out the work of Dr. Marko Milkovic. His PhD thesis on the Yugoslav atomic bomb project, Tito's Proliferation Puzzle, is by far the most comprehensive work on this unique piece of history, and he's writing a future book on it as well, and I hope to read it when it is ready. Jacques Hymans of USC also did a great job explaining the program in the context of other state nuclear weapons programs. His book, Achieving Nuclear Ambitions, was excellent. I also want to beg forgiveness about my pronunciations of people's names here. I did indeed look up the ways, but I'm not Serbian. I gave it my best. Now on with the show. In 1909, a guy named Pavle Savic was born in Greece, settling in Belgrade. He grew up with a deep interest in the sciences, graduating from the University of Belgrade with a degree in the physical sciences. Savic then married and went to France, where he was eventually accepted to study physics under the legendary Irene Joliot-Curie at the Radium Institute. Irene was Marie Curie's daughter and herself a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. It was an exciting time to be in nuclear physics. In 1939, Savic studied the effects of uranium bombardment by neutrons. Understanding such reactions are crucial to today's nuclear weapons and reactors. That same year, 1939, Savic also joined the Yugoslav Communist Party, meeting Tito in Paris for the first time. Shortly afterwards, World War II broke out. The Radium Institute ended their work, and France sent Savic back to his home country, where he joined the Yugoslav Partisans. As one of the few physicists with practical overseas experience in physics, Tito valued him. In 1944, Savic was sent to Moscow as part of a Yugoslav delegation to possibly secure future Soviet backing and make connections as a scientific attaché. There, he joined one of the Soviet science institutes, the Institute of Physical Problems. In Moscow, he befriended members of the Soviet atomic bomb project, including future Nobel Prize winner Pyotr Kapitsa. He worked on liquid helium research and even received an offer, though later withdrawn, to work on their fission projects. But with the Yugoslav partisans on the verge of victory, Tito recalled him back to Belgrade. Then in another reversal, Savic returned to Moscow the next year, ostensibly to learn how to rebuild the University of Belgrade. In late 1946, Savic returned to Yugoslavia with his family for a well-timed vacation. It came at a time of worsening relations between the two socialist nations. Unable to return to the Soviet Union, Savic took a position at the university. Soon thereafter, Tito called him into action once more. In the second half of 1947, the Yugoslav government founded the Institute of Physics at the village of Vinča, about 12 kilometers outside Belgrade. This had been done at the behest of the Soviet Union, a way to connect the two countries. Savic was asked to oversee its construction and serve as its founding director, and he styled it after the research institutes he saw in the Soviet Union. But Tito's desire for independence eventually exposed a rift between himself and Stalin. In 1948, disagreements over Tito's encroaching influence in Greece, and particularly Albania, led to the exchange of letters that presaged the momentous Tito-Stalin split. Tito initially tried to repair relations, but the situation continued to deteriorate throughout 1948 and into early 1949. Fears of a possible Soviet military invasion, paired with the news of the first Soviet atomic bomb that August, likely cemented Tito's determination for a bomb of their own. Yugoslavia's nuclear program centered on three institutes. In addition to the first nuclear research institute in Vinča, later named the Boris Kidrich Institute after the country's lead economist, there were two others. In 1949, the government founded what would eventually be called the Josef Stefan Institut in Slovenia. Today, it is Slovenia's largest research institute. And in 1950, the Rudyard Boskovic Institute in Croatia. Its founding director was Ivan Supek. Supek was quite special, a talented physicist who trained under Werner Heisenberg himself, but also boasting formidable anti-fascist credentials built up while working with the Yugoslav partisans during the war. An atomic program cannot be successful without fuel. Fortunately, Yugoslavia found some within their borders, located with the partial help of the Soviets. In the late 1940s, the US and Soviets raced to secure known deposits of uranium around the world, the Americans in the Belgian Congo, the Soviets in Czechoslovakia and East Germany. In mid-1947, between July and October, a delegation of Soviet scientists and geologists came to Yugoslavia with little formal notice. The delegation began searching the country's mines for something, not saying what. One unnamed Yugoslav geologist accompanied them, recording his observations. He remembers seeing the Soviets taking rocks from various mines and measuring them with tools that looked like spectroscopes. The Soviets eventually returned to the Bulgarian border, carrying a few samples with them. It did not take long for the Yugoslavs to realize what happened. Soon after, they discovered autunite, a weak uranium ore, near a Serbian city called Prokuplje. Lacking technical help from either the Americans or Soviets, the search for uranium was aided by dozens of Germans working in Yugoslavia. They were either brought in as part of reparations for the war, or secretly spirited in from Soviet-dominated Berlin by the Yugoslav secret police, the UDB. The Germans' efforts helped produce the equipment to detect radioactivity, measure magnetic signals in Yugoslav mines, produce maps, and refine uranium ore. Such technologies were incredibly secret and needed to be developed from scratch. In addition to the autunite, they found larger deposits in eastern Serbia near the village of Kalna. The UDB began building a mining complex in the area. The weapons program was supervised by Tito's security head, Alexander Rankovic. Reserved but fiercely loyal to Tito, Rankovic led the aforementioned UDB, or Yugoslav secret police, making him perhaps the country's third most powerful man. His role overseeing the Yugoslav weapons program echoed that of Leventi Beria, the Soviet secret police head who ran the Soviet atomic bomb program. The UDB's oversight of the atomic bomb program, coming in the wake of the Tito-Stalin split, lowered a veil of secrecy, compartmentalization, and paranoia over the program. Participants were chosen not for their expertise, but rather their loyalty to communist ideals. Despite this veil of secrecy, the UDB helped provide a flow of literature and equipment that otherwise would not have been available. The secret police was also very good at mobilizing labor, forced or otherwise, for mining, construction, whatever was needed. This continued throughout the program's existence. To train the Institute's first generation of technicians and make the shopping list for acquisition by the UDB, Savage recruited a Dutch nuclear physicist named Robert J. Wallen to Vinča. Wallen, a French Communist Party member, stayed until 1954 and helped get the program off to a good start. In 1952, the renowned Norwegian nuclear physicist Gunnar Randers visited the Yugoslav Nuclear Institutes. He praised them for high quality and fast progress in such a short period of time. At the time, it staffed over 80 scientists and technicians engaged in physics, chemistry, biology, and math work. The Tito-Stalin split placed Yugoslavia in a new geopolitically important position between the East and the West. They leveraged this to benefit handsomely from both sides. Western transfers to Yugoslavia helped revitalize the ruined economy. Their economic and technology transfers in cars, electronics, and health equipment, I discussed a few of these in prior videos. In addition to these, there were transfers in the nuclear sciences. In late December 1953, U.S. President Eisenhower gave his Atoms for Peace speech at the United Nations. It and the initiative that followed sought to promote the peaceful use of atomic energy around the world. I discuss Atoms for Peace in a prior video about India's nuclear weapons program. In that video, I noted how it helped accelerate India's progress towards nuclear weapons. Once top secret equipment and know-how were now available for acquisition, the Americans, Soviets, and the British competed to offer the most nuclear aid and guidance to their key allies and gain political influence in doing so. Most Atoms for Peace participants lacked the development, talents, or infrastructure to accept aid. But that was not the case with Yugoslavia. They were already uniquely well along on domestic nuclear development, which combined with their special geopolitical place made them a valued target. When the Intergovernmental Nuclear Research Organization CERN was founded in 1954, Yugoslavia was invited to join as one of the 12 founding members, an indication of their valued status within Europe. Then, in September 1955, the Americans came to Belgrade and put on an exhibition on nuclear power at the Zagreb International Trade Fair, one of the first such in a communist country. But then the Soviets swooped in. Relations had warmed after Stalin's death in 1953 and Nikita Khrushchev's subsequent rise. The Yugoslavs wanted a large heavy water reactor and enriched uranium fuel. In August 1955, Westinghouse wrote a letter offering a 10-megawatt pressured water reactor, the same type used for the Nautilus nuclear submarine. Yugoslavia was the first communist country of any sort to receive such American preference. The Soviets moved fast to offer something similar, a 6.5-megawatt reactor capable of going to 10 megawatts, but seemingly attached far more liberal conditions. Yugoslavia would get to participate in the underlying technology and request specific modifications. Plus, they got to own the heavy water and the uranium fuel. It looked like a seriously good deal that fit with Savich and others' desire for independent development, and the fact that it was the same reactor given to the People's Republic of China was political brownie points. Thus, in January 1956, the Soviets and the Yugoslavs sealed the pact, leaving the Americans somewhat shocked. Not to be dissuaded, the Americans later offered equipment and even a small, very basic Triga Mark II research reactor. It fired up at the Josef Stefan Institute in Slovenia in 1966. However, American insistence on strong controls, including facility inspection visits, plus the ongoing pact with the Soviets, impeded further, deeper cooperation. To produce a bomb, you needed a design and a critical mass of nuclear material, either plutonium or highly enriched uranium. One of the challenges of a weapons program is getting or producing enough of this nuclear material. Yugoslavia's plan towards atomic bomb production, first designed in 1957 by a central planning committee, was to build a series of increasingly powerful nuclear reactors. These reactors would produce the needed nuclear material. The first reactor was the aforementioned 6.5 megawatt reactor that the Soviets agreed to transfer over to them, called the RA. This RA would ideally be fed with uranium fuel produced domestically. After the successful RA transfer, the program would then build a larger plant, producing 65 megawatts of thermal power by 1965. 5 years later, in 1970, the Yugoslavs would complete a third, even larger plant, producing 250 megawatts of thermal power. This third 1970 reactor would be large enough to produce the necessary amount of plutonium for a test explosion and 10 bombs a year, eventually. This plan follows the line of India's atomic bomb program, the Canadian-designed Cirrus research reactor that they received in 1955, converted natural uranium into weapons-grade plutonium-239 via neutron bombardment. That formed the basis for their bomb. Yet there was a faster way to a bomb, if so desired. China's first atomic bomb, detonated in 1964, used uranium-235. Uranium-235 is pretty rare in nature. However, there are ways to separate this uranium-235 from the more common uranium-238 without a reactor. Once you get enough uranium-235, generally 80%+ enrichment, you can integrate it into a bomb design, particularly an implosion-type design which requires less fissile material. In doing so, you skip having to produce plutonium in these increasingly larger reactors, which is good because reactors are big, expensive, and very visible to everybody in the global community. This is what China eventually did, and it demonstrates both how badly they wanted the weapon as soon as possible, plus their mastery of the basic nuclear physics behind it. Yugoslav planners either did not know about China's approach, or they were also thinking about the reactors' civilian benefits for generating power. The idea seems to have been that they wanted their cake and to eat it too. As the RA was being built, Yugoslavia decided to first produce another reactor, a zero-power reactor called the RB. As the name implies, this first reactor was meant for training rather than generating power or producing plutonium, an indigenous prototype to stretch the industry's wings for future work. The reactor first went live in May 1958, 2 years after India's swimming pool-type reactor, Apsara, went live. This made Yugoslavia the first Balkan country to perform a nuclear chain reaction of any kind, a point of national pride. The RB reactor's core was assembled from uranium fuel slugs cladded in aluminium, immersed in a tank of heavy water to moderate the fission reactions. The aluminium tank is suspended in the air by a metal frame, and below is a basin to catch any leaking water. Zero-power reactors, like the RB, are designed to be very simple and safe. But in October 1958, just 6 months after the RB went live, the Institute suffered a horrible accident. During an experiment, the heavy water level unexpectedly rose, causing a supercriticality incident. However, nobody knew about it until people started smelling ozone in the air about 10 minutes after the incident occurred. Six reactor operators then standing close to the reactor were hit with large doses of radiation. Everyone quickly evacuated, but apparently one last operator, a 24-year-old physics student named Života Voranič, went back into the facility to turn off the reactor, which required climbing up onto the metal frame. The six irradiated victims received doses believed to be fatal about 50% of the time. They were sent to Paris for treatment at the Radium Institute. One recovered thanks to traditional blood transfusion treatments. Four others survived thanks to the world's first successful bone marrow graft between unrelated hosts and donors, performed by the French oncologist Georges Mathé. Voranič, unfortunately, however, received too large of a dose and passed away. A scholarship fund was established in his honor, and the media elevated him to the level of a national hero and pioneer. What exactly happened then is not entirely clear. In an interview given in 1986, nearly three decades later, Savić said, "Even with a bicycle, if you remove the brake, you can break your neck." And that's exactly what happened in 1958 in Vinča. They suffered due to their own negligence as they removed all the brakes from the instruments. In response to this, one of the irradiated survivors, Stiepo Hadukovic, published an account after his death in 1997 saying that none of the six reactor operators removed anything and argued that the reactor had not been safe. The only tool to measure the heavy water level was a rod. There was no way to automatically shut the reactor down, and the safety alarms had been turned off, apparently so not to startle people. He blamed the work supervisors for carelessly doing experiments without any safety precautions. The Vinča incident was an embarrassment to the party's nuclear ambitions. After all, the RB reactor was their pride and joy, so domestically they hushed it down. It became clear to the government that the nuclear project was far harder and needed far more investment than first anticipated. New procedures and radiation protections had to be developed. But there was one upside to the whole thing, if you can call it that. The accident helped internationalize Yugoslavia's atomic efforts. The investigation of the accident had been one of the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA's, first official acts. That investigation allowed the government to both display its openness to the international nuclear community and build deeper connections into that community, which became very valuable considering what happened next with the Soviet partnership. I mentioned in my prior video about the Chinese atomic bomb project that there were great differences between what the Soviets said and what they actually did. What the Soviets promised back to the Yugoslavs when signing their pact in 1956 looked on the surface like a wonderful deal. The RA was based on a design already given to the Chinese, but with modifications to let it use Yugoslavia's naturally occurring uranium fuel. The Soviets also promised to teach Yugoslavian scientists the art of refining uranium ore into fuel. Whatever the Yugoslavs demanded, the Soviets agreed. But alas, it was too good to be true. The Soviets reneged on virtually everything, running the same delay tactics they ran with the Chinese. Now that the agreement was signed, the Soviets can quote-unquote steer the Yugoslav program in the way they truly wanted. Soon after signing, the Soviets claimed that it was too complicated to modify the reactor design. They sent faulty parts that broke down after a while and then delayed the replacements. They also stonewalled the Yugoslav scientists' training and knowledge transfer, and yet the Yugoslavs had little choice but to go along. The RA reactor nominally entered operation in 1959, but soon after the opening ceremony, Yugoslav officials diagnosed many technical problems. Worse yet, nobody knew how to fix the reactor's problems because nobody knew actually how it worked, because the Soviets did such a terrible job, or great one, depending on your perspective, of transferring knowledge on its inner workings. So, the RA reactor sort of just meandered on until 1984, when it was shut down. Then in 2002, it was decommissioned with its highly enriched uranium fuel sent back to Russia. The RA reactor remains in Vinča, and all in all, the Soviet-Yugoslav cooperation from 1955 to 1959 had been a waste of time and resources. In the early 1960s, Tito decided to halt the atomic weapon program. Tito ran Yugoslavia with a great deal of flexibility, adapting to changing geopolitical circumstances as necessary. And circumstances had indeed changed, especially after Stalin's death in 1953. Stalin's passing largely ended the threat of a Soviet military invasion. Without that overhanging him, Tito began to realize that the risks of having an active atomic bomb project outweighed its benefits. Dr. Marko Milkovic at the Institute of Economic Sciences in Belgrade wrote about how nuclear proliferation presented a potential risk to Yugoslavia's independence. West Germany and Italy both wanted the bomb. If such a thing ever happened, then Yugoslavia would be surrounded by nuclear-armed powers, destabilizing Tito's regime even if they achieved the bomb themselves. So the country plunged into non-proliferation efforts. They became one of the leading countries alongside India in promoting global nuclear disarmament. So it would be a bit hypocritical and wasteful to be promoting all that while also spending huge sums on secretly developing a bomb. In 1961, Yugoslavia withdrew from CERN, and around that time, Dragoslav Popovic, a high-ranking member of the nuclear program, recalls Alexander Rankovic being ordered, probably by Tito himself, to freeze the atomic weapons program. But that was not the end. Despite the freeze and the unproductive Soviet partnership, the Yugoslav atomic program continued putting the pieces together. Milkovic theorizes that Rankovic agreed to the freeze order from Tito on the surface and slashed its budget, but Rankovic continued driving towards a possible weapon under the guise of civilian development. Progress was made through various efforts. Significantly, there were research and training collaborations with Norway. In the 1950s, Norway was a world leader in nuclear energy technology and the sixth country in the world to build a nuclear reactor. Norwegian and Yugoslav researchers shared political viewpoints and knew each other very well personally, frequently consulting on technical issues. In the 1950s, Norway became the only country to accept and train Yugoslav scientists on reactor physics. This culminated in agreement to transfer the engineering plans for a Purex plant from a Norwegian company called NorAtom to Vinča. Purex stands for Plutonium Uranium Reduction Extraction, and it is a method of extracting plutonium or other weapons-grade material from spent uranium fuel. The plant began operations in 1966, ostensibly for reprocessing the RA reactor's spent fuel. It was laboratory scale with four hot cells producing only 0.7 grams of OK pure plutonium. But Yugoslavia knew how to reconfigure the equipment to get a purer weapons-grade plutonium, and with the engineering plans in hand, they could also scale up production if they so wanted. One of the reasons Yugoslavia cited for leaving CERN had been, quote, difficulties with Yugoslavs who did not want to return, end quote. In other words, their talented and well-trained scientists were leaving. Atoms for Peace had helped create a thriving industry. Western institutions funded scholarships and new positions, giving talented Yugoslavs an opportunity to grab better-paying, more prestigious jobs abroad. And since they were allowed to travel abroad and interact with various members of the international nuclear community, these Yugoslavs had the contacts to get these opportunities. You also cannot ignore the political aspect. Yugoslavia was certainly more open than the Soviet Union, but nowhere near as open as the West. Scientists disagreeing with the government had the option to exit and often took it. Yet this brain drain had a dark side too. It allowed the ongoing Yugoslav atomic weapons program to place their countrymen in privileged positions abroad, including within the IAEA itself. There, these people continued supplying serious, top-secret nuclear details back to their home government. This information helped the program skip expensive pathfinding efforts and achieve what would have previously taken years. Most audaciously, Yugoslavia tried to get the IAEA to fund and build a medium-sized nuclear reactor within their borders. This reactor was ostensibly to be a training ground for people from non-aligned countries, but it could also be a stepping stone towards producing bomb materials, lifted right from the aforementioned 1957 Yugoslav plan for increasingly larger reactors. However, the proposal did not pass scientific scrutiny. Ivan Supek, the founding director of the Rudolf Boscovich Institute and dissident, savvily critiqued it as being uneconomical for civilian purpose alone. The quiet part, of course, being that the plan's real goal was for a bomb. Supek himself later speculated that Renkovich wanted to seize the state nuclear science apparatus as a vehicle to empower himself or his UDB cohorts. Such suspicions only intensified after the uranium mine in Kalna began work in 1962. It is not entirely clear why Renkovich continued the atomic weapons program right under Tito's nose. Perhaps he felt it necessary for his country's survival, or, as Supek said, it was a play to grab power or resources for his cohorts. But his efforts throughout the 1960s put the country closer than ever to a potential nuclear weapon if it so desired. The pieces were all there. You had the secret police still bringing in a stream of top-secret information acquired from the West. There was the uranium mine at Kalna, which had enough uranium ore to produce at least a few weapons. And unbeknownst to Yugoslavia, there was a yet larger mine within its borders, though it laid undiscovered until later. And then there was the Purex plutonium reprocessing plant transferred over from Norway, which could have been scaled up to an industrial venture. The only missing thing was a reactor to produce the spent nuclear fuel for said Purex plant. Had the government or the IAEA funded one, the bomb would have been within reach. In the end, however, that did not come to pass. By 1963, Renkovich was out of the nuclear program entirely. Such attempts to work around Tito probably contributed to his later fall from power in 1966. And then in 1968, Yugoslavia signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, ending any final thoughts or attempts at a nuclear weapon. In 1970, Yugoslavia ratified the NPT and dissolved their Federal Nuclear Energy Commission, the once powerful council which had overseen their nuclear work since 1955. In 1974, India detonated what they called a peaceful nuclear explosion, if one could ever call such a thing that, and it triggered one final grasp for the bomb. Tito must have seen the detonation as a potential threat. A month later, he called a meeting of the armed and intelligence forces. Tito then demanded that the country operate a civilian nuclear program to disguise a second program crafting a bomb, called Program A. There was some movement, but too much had been lost since the 1970 shutdown. Over 1,300 talented scientists had left the country for better posts abroad. The uranium mine at Kalna had been shut down for several years. And the international atomic community had tightened its restrictions on nuclear materials with potential dual-use possibilities. And of course, Yugoslavia had previously signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty with its safeguards. It was too late. One Croatian physicist, Ivo Slaus, present at the 1974 meeting, thought the whole thing was a bluff rather than a real attempt. Everyone nodded in agreement, but little actually happened afterwards. Tito himself passed away 6 years later. In the end, Yugoslavia got a lot closer to the atomic bomb than you might expect. They had access to uranium fuel, strong nuclear research institutes, connections to the international atomic community, and could have had a pathway to enough material for a bomb. But a few things went wrong. The partnership did not deliver, and the geopolitical winds changed. Once they shut it down the first time, getting it back was no longer practical. And good thing too, considering the turmoil that engulfed Yugoslavia after Tito's death, imagine what the presence of nuclear weapons would have meant for the region. Yugoslavia's nuclear program retains a legacy, though. Vinča still has a bunch of nuclear waste. Plus, there is the abandoned Kalna uranium mine. Lots of this stuff is radioactive still, and the Serbian government has to figure out how to get rid of it. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.